What do you know of ancient Athens? The tiny Greek city-state that produced some of the most famous and infamous characters we know of in history. And it's fascinating that the city of Athens was named after Athena, the goddess not only of wisdom, but the art of war. And it's a fitting name because the two things that the ancient Athenians are most known for are thinking and fighting. The very life of Athens was like that of a professional boxer. They were always getting ready to fight, fighting, or resting in between rounds of fighting. Yet in between these fights and wars with Persia and Sparta, they put forth ideas that are still taught verbatim 2,400 years later. In my research for this show, I came across an article titled, "What Made Ancient Athens a City of Genius?" where journalist Eric Weiner had this to say, quote, "Ancient Athens was a place of public opulence and private squalor. The streets were noisy, narrow, and dirty. The houses of the wealthy were indistinguishable from the houses of the poor, and both were equally shoddy, constructed of wood and sun-dried clay, and so flimsy that robbers gained entry simply by digging. How did a small, dirty, crowded city, surrounded by enemies and swathed in olive oil, manage to change the world? Was Athenian genius simply the convergence of a happy set of circumstances, as the historian Peter Watson has put it, or did the Athenians make their luck? This question has stumped historians and archaeologists for centuries." Unquote. So how did this small city-state, a little speck on the map of empires, create and ignite the flame of democracy, a concept that would illuminate the Western world? It was here, amidst the marble and olive groves, that the fragile vessel of democracy was first cradled, its contents as volatile as they were precious. American democracy is kind of like that teenager, you know, with an attitude now. Still kind of doesn't know exactly what it's supposed to do, like allowing everyone the right to vote without suppression and gender equality and full self-governance and so on and so forth. These ideals, though, imperfectly realized, trace their lineage back to the heart of Athens, where the concept of placing power in the palms of the populace first took root. But how did this budding idea of democracy emerge from the rocky Athenian soil? And more intriguingly, how did such a society give rise to a titan of thought, an intellectual colossus known as Socrates? Maybe the secret lies within the cosmopolitan lifeblood of Athens, a city pulsating with the exchange of ideas. It was a city that looked beyond its own horizons, borrowing liberally from foreign lands, welcoming outsiders into its midst, and in doing so, becoming a melting pot where philosophy, democracy, and culture were forged into something transcendent, something enduring. The Athenians, with their insatiable curiosity, ventured forth to the corners of the known world. They sat at the feet of the greatest shipbuilders of Egypt. They wandered the hallowed halls of the grandest libraries and returned, minds brimming with the knowledge of the ages. And as they welcomed the world into their city, they insisted upon a singular creed. To be Athenian was to be engaged, to be active in the lifeblood of the polis. To withdraw into the shadows was not an option, ancient historian Thucydides wrote, quote, "The man who took no interest in the affairs of the state was not a man who minded his own business, but a man with no business being in Athens at all," unquote. In the Agora, the vibrant heart of Athens, where the threads of commerce, conversation, politics, and religion intertwined, the citizenry found their stage. Here, amidst the bustle of daily life, where one could purchase olives, witness the spectacle of theater, and debate the nature of virtue, the spirit of public discourse thrived. And it was there, in this fertile ground of dialogue and debate, that we find Socrates, our protagonist, a man who penned nothing himself, yet whose legacy was etched into eternity by the words of others. Socrates, who stood as a testament to the pursuit of knowledge, famously said, quote, "All that I know is that I know nothing," unquote. With this humble confession, he laid the foundation for a philosophy that championed the relentless quest for understanding over the complacency of assumed knowledge. It is a statement that resonates with profound humility and wisdom, reminding us that the journey of learning is infinite, that the moment we stop questioning, we cease to grow. As we stand on the shoulders of this intellectual giant, we are reminded that the essence of our humanity is not in the certainties we claim, but in the questions we dare to ask. Imagine, if you will, the figure of Socrates, a name that now conjures the very essence of philosophical inquiry. The father of Western philosophy, philosophy a term that sings of the love of wisdom. And Socrates, oh, how he danced to its tune, revealing the boundless landscapes of the mind. He taught us to question, to relentlessly pursue the why behind the what. And in doing so, he birthed the Socratic method, a legacy of learning that champions the power of a question over the certainty of the answer. It's almost funny, isn't it? Socrates, the man who professed to know so little, led so many to such profound knowledge, and he urged his students to embark on a journey of self-discovery, to arrive at their own truths. This clarion call to think for yourself echoes down the corridors of time. Socrates, born in the year 469 BCE to Sophroniscus, a stonemason by trade, and Phanereti, a midwife by profession. Excuse my tongue if I misstep in pronunciations here. But even in his youth, Socrates was marked by an insatiable thirst for knowledge. And so then we find Socrates transitioning from boy to man, donning the armor of a hoplite, serving in the Athenian army with a valor that would rival the heroes of old in the Battle of Potidaea. His deeds were the stuff of legend, shielding his comrades, spear in hand, amidst the chaos of war. But he always questioned, even in the army. He would ask things like, what is the nature of courage and what makes a good commander? Let me paint a picture from the pages of Plato's Dialogues, a vignette that captures the soul of Socrates returning from the Peloponnesian Wars, a series of grueling campaigns against the Spartans. Socrates finds himself amongst the familiar faces of the young men of Athens. They were hungry for tales of war, eager for the gritty details of battle, and Socrates, ever the patient mentor, indulged their curiosity, recounting the ordeals of war. But then, in a turn, Socrates pivots the conversation. Does he dwell on the horrors of war? No, he inquires about the latest developments in philosophy and the rising stars of wisdom and beauty in Athens. And here lies the enigma of Socrates, a man seemingly untouched by the scars of war, his spirit unburdened, his focus unwavering on the life of the mind. And this is where the story gets a little mythical. You almost have to believe in the story of Socrates, almost like you believe in Jesus or Buddha, or maybe it's the other way around and you have to suspend disbelief. It's said that he could withstand extreme hardship, whether it was wearing minimal clothing during freezing winters or walking barefoot for grueling long distances. There are stories such as the one in Xenophon's Symposium, where Socrates is said to have stood outside in a trance for 24 hours, enduring the elements without concern. He was known for his ability to resist basic human desires and needs. He drank goblets of wine without becoming drunk. And when it came to the bedroom, let's just say Socrates practiced a kind of philosophical celibacy. In a city where a good toga party could easily turn into a scene from a fresco that would make your mother blush, Socrates was likely debating the ethics of desire with anyone who'd listen, and even with those who wouldn't. He's like the designated driver of morality. And get this, Socrates often mentioned a daemon or an inner voice that would warn him against certain actions. This has been interpreted as a form of divine intuition or moral conscience. Socrates himself left no written legacy. It is through the eyes of his disciples that we glimpse his life, a life that, to some historians, presents a puzzle as intricate as the man himself, and this conundrum, known as the Socratic problem, challenges scholars to sift through the accounts to discern the man from the myth. Socrates' journey really starts when one of his friends asks a question to the Oracle of Delphi. These oracles were thought to have communicated with and been the mouthpiece for the Greek god Apollo himself. Anyone could go to them and they answered questions 9 months out of the year on the seventh day of the month. And in Plato's Apology, we refer to Plato a lot because he is the main biographer of Socrates. He was a student of Socrates, and Socrates had a profound influence on Plato. So most of what we know about Socrates comes from the writing of Plato. And in Plato's Apology, he has Socrates saying, quote, Chaerephon went to Delphi and was so bold as to ask the oracle this question, and gentlemen, don't make a disturbance of what I say. For he asked if there were anyone wiser than I, Socrates. Now the Pythia, the priestess who held court at Pytho, replied that there was no one wiser. When I heard that, I thought to myself, what in the world does God mean? What riddle is he propounding? For I am conscious that I am not wise either much or little. What then does he mean by declaring that I am the wisest? He certainly cannot be lying, for that is not possible for him. And for a long time, I was at a loss as to what he meant. Then, with great reluctance, I proceeded to investigate him somewhat as follows. I went to one who had a reputation for wisdom, thinking that there, if anywhere, I should prove the utterance wrong and should show the oracle, this man is wiser than I. But you said I was the wisest. So examining this man and conversing with him, this man seemed to be wise to many other people and especially to himself, but not to be so. And then I tried to show him that he thought he was wise, but was not. As a result, I became hateful to him and to many of those present. And so I went away. I thought to myself, I am wiser than this man, for neither of us really knows anything fine and good, but this man thinks he knows something when he does not, whereas I do not know anything and do not think I know either. I seem then, in just this little thing, to be wiser than this man. At any rate, that what I do not know, I do not think I know either. Unquote. This is at the heart, this is at the core of the whole Socratic philosophy. Picture this, a deity through the voice of an oracle proclaims you, the singular you, as the wisest of all. It's not just a statement, it's a cosmic verdict that seeps into the marrow of your being. What life path would you tread then? If you truly, irrevocably believed in this divine wisdom, might you not cast aside all else in pursuit of this celestial calling? This isn't just a hypothetical musing, it's the crossroads where Socrates found himself. The oracle at Delphi, a mouthpiece of the gods, declared him the wisest of mortals. And Socrates, he embarked on a quest not to bask in the glory of his title, but to disprove it. Yet in his search, he found a peculiar truth. While everyone professed knowledge, few could substantiate it. In this sea of unexamined lives, Socrates' admission of his own ignorance became his beacon of wisdom. Now we can think about this and think about how have you questioned your deepest assumptions? Think about your most adhered to and clung to beliefs. How often do you question them? How often are you open to the ideas that could change your mind? In the Socratic way, this questioning is how we come to the truth. Now fast forward and we find Socrates now an eccentric figure draped in poverty, meandering through the agora. His appearance, let's just say he wouldn't be the poster child for Athenian beauty. Descriptions of him paint a picture of a man who would stand in today's world just as he did in his own time, unkempt with the wild gaze of a man who was lost in thought. We're told that he was remarkably ugly, dirty, and disheveled, wandering around the street in unwashed bedclothes and long matted hair. There's other accounts of him. It says he has these bulging eyes that always look like he was staring. Not even straight, but sideways. And they said he had the mouth of a frog. And then there's Xanthippe, Socrates' wife, who must have had the patience of a saint or maybe just the resignation of someone who's lost the receipt for their husband. If the stories are true, Xanthippe wasn't exactly the president of the Socrates fan club. You can picture her, can't you? Arms crossed, tapping her foot as Socrates turned their home into ancient Athens' answer to a 24/7 philosophy drive-thru. So here's Xanthippe married to a guy whose idea of a couple's date was a deep dive into the nature of virtue. And you gotta wonder if she ever just wanted to scream, Socrates, can you take out the trash? And he responded, But what is trash? Is not the refuse of life, but the surplus of existence? To which Xanthippe might reply, no, it's the garbage, and it stinks, can you please take it out? And that, everyone, is the man who laid the foundations of Western philosophy, the thinker. Now, it's important to know that during this time that Socrates wasn't thought of well by everyone. Most people probably thought he was insane, this dirty, homeless-looking man walking around and trying to question them. To many, he was a figure of controversy, a man whose relentless questioning and unkempt appearance branded him as a societal outlier. Aristophanes, with the sharp quill of a satirist, painted him as a charlatan, a master of deception cloaked in the guise of a philosopher. His portrayal of Socrates is scathing. Says he's just a peddler of words, a man who could argue any position, regardless if it was true or not. He said, quote, he was a bold rascal, a fine speaker, impudent, shameless, a braggart and adept at stringing lies, a fox to slip through any hole, strapped slippery as an eel, an artful fellow, a bluster, a villain, a knave with 100 faces, cunning, intolerable, a gluttonous dog, unquote. Not a very flattering depiction of the great Western philosopher now, is it? And of course, this is one view when surely those in his own time, again, they may have viewed him as a nobody, maybe even a public nuisance. What would you do if you were going out to the grocery store and this man approached you every time you went, asking you what the meaning of life was? But the thing is, Socrates had a very profound and life-changing effect on some of the more influential Athenians, Plato and Xenophon. And Plato came from a very wealthy background. He was said to be this handsome guy who studied wrestling and philosophy and poetry, and Socrates taught him. And then Plato would go on to be the person who would open the first academy in the Western world, where he taught Aristotle, and then Aristotle went on to teach Alexander the Great. So you could see how this kind of starts coming down through the Western history, right? Socrates is the intellectual father of them all, and that's why he's called the father of Western philosophy. And so these are where the positive stories come from, these influential Athenians whose words have been set in stone or on paper and passed down to us. Now, there's one of Socrates' admirers. His name is Alcibiades, and he's a statesman and a student, and he says, quote, Socrates' arguments seem ridiculous the first time you hear them, but if you see them taken apart and get inside of them, you will find them to be the only arguments that are reasonable, arguments that are the most godlike, arguments holding inside a wealth of algamata, of divine excellence, arguments that are largely, no, completely intent on everything proper for becoming a noble and good man, unquote. Roman philosopher Cicero years later says, quote, Socrates wrestled philosophy from the heavens and brought it down to earth, unquote. And this brings us to his philosophy. And I want to break this down in a way that doesn't lose you. And I've even struggled a bit because as you read these books on Socrates and these interpretations and historians and academics, the people writing about him, they can get real dry and colorless and uninspiring when they write about his philosophy. And you could be reading a book that's like 1,000 pages. So I'm going to break it into just some fundamentals or some of my key takeaways that resonated with me. The Cliff Notes. And so for me personally, when we talk about Socrates, we have to turn to line 38 in Plato's Apology, when Socrates says, quote, the unexamined life is not worth living, unquote. This is more than a catchy phrase. It's the cornerstone of the Socratic method, a call to action for every thinking individual. It's about the relentless pursuit of truth through questioning, not just any questioning, but the kind that digs deep, that doesn't take, because that's the way it always has been done for an answer. The method known as Alencus is a dance of arguments and counterarguments, questions leading to more questions until the fog of confusion lifts and the landscape of understanding becomes clear. It's not about winning an argument. It's about peeling back the layers of assumption and reaching the core of what's true and just. So the Socratic method clarified the concepts of justice and injustice, moral and immoral problems. It was very much moral philosophy. And you can look at the Socratic method Now, I'll give you a real world example. Say if you have kids, for instance, or students, you could use the Socratic method right now as we speak by just asking them this question. Would you buy a stolen bicycle? And they're going to say yes or no. And then you say, what if that stolen bicycle was the only way for you to get 100 miles from where you are rather than walking? And you didn't have any shoes on. And then you see how this can go on and on until you get to what the greater good is. Or some kind of moral truth of what is good for society. Because again, this is always tying back to citizenship. It's about what is honorable or what is virtuous or what is the upright thing to do. So this isn't just a question for the sake of questioning or arguing for the sake of arguing, like we see with so many of our political divides. Again, this is coming from a people who agree that we are a community and we're trying to come to the greater good of our community and the greater good as citizens. And one professor really had a great name for these debates. He called it productive discomfort. There's a tension in these dialogues that you may be called or held into account for your beliefs, and you have to defend your values, you have to defend your notions, and then in turn, as you grow as a citizen, then you may call on your nation or your neighbor or your friends to be accountable to their beliefs, to their ideas, to their deepest assumptions. I hope you can see that this is the stuff that democracy is made of. This is the stuff that community is made of, developing the courage and the forums to criticize each other's actions, each other's thoughts, starting, and this is most important, with questioning our own thoughts. And on a bigger scale, it helps us to identify injustice and critically question it. And so from my perspective, then I ask myself, how does Socratic questioning deal with racism? How does it deal with crime and punishment? How does it deal with wealth inequality? How does it deal with sexism? How does Socratic questioning deal with educational inequality? How does it deal with war? It's assertive. It's not passive. It's a way of life and it's a way of being, and it's engaged and it's not disengaged. And this is the legacy. It's a legacy that's been the bedrock of legal systems. It's been the pulse in the veins of scientific discovery. It's the very framework that has been used to challenge the status quo, to peel back the layers of assumption and expose the core truth beneath. You can find it in the hallowed halls of business schools, in problem-based learning clinics and classrooms training the next generation. It's just as much at home in a Silicon Valley think tank as it is in the Athenian Agora. In the digital age where information is everywhere, the Socratic method is an ark and helps us navigate the flood of fake news to discern the truth in an ocean of misinformation. It's a compass for the modern mind, guiding us through the complexities of our era. And maybe most important, the Socratic method is not just for public debate. It's a mirror for self-reflection, a tool for personal evolution. Asking yourself the hard questions, peering into the abyss of our own ignorance and emerging wiser, more attuned to the nuances of our own existence. Socrates also says that I cannot teach anyone. I can only make them think. And so in the tapestry of this Socratic philosophy, we find threads that weave through the very fabric of our being, urging us to question, to challenge, to grow. Socrates didn't impose knowledge, but sparked the flame of thought, illuminating the path to self-discovery. There's another story in the Republic where Socrates asked a man named Cephalus whether paying what one owes and returning what has been left with someone is just. And Cephalus says, yes, it's just. And then we're told that Socrates asked, is giving a prospective murderer his sword back also just? Cephalus says, no, it wouldn't be. And then Socrates sees there are holes in the traditional ideas of justice. So there's this idea that truth is sometimes nuanced, and morally, again, we have to think about the greater good. So then you could see this legacy emerging. And it's still with us today. It's been with us. Those who have had the courage to critically question the justice system have sometimes changed the justice system. For those who take the time to examine and question themselves often make themselves better and their friends better, their spouses or their children. And we could go on and on talking about the philosophy. But now I want to take you to the year 399 BCE. Here the Athenian air was thick with the tension of a trial that would etch itself into the pages of history. Socrates, a figure both revered and reviled, stood alone before the imposing assembly of 500 citizens as jurors. The charges were severe and the implications dire, impiety towards the pantheon of Athens and the corruption of its youth. In a city where democracy was still in its infancy, such accusations bore the weight of a death sentence. Athens had little tolerance for religious deviance. The very fabric of the city-state was interwoven with the worship of its many gods, and here was Socrates audaciously championing the cause of a singular divine entity. His bold proclamation that a singular God spoke through him was nothing short of blasphemy, a transgression that could lead him to the hemlock cup. The courtroom was a cauldron of whispers and wary glances as the trial commenced. Wooden benches groaned under the weight of jurors, each aware that the day's decision would reverberate through time. Socrates' accusers, three men of Athens, were granted a triad of hours to make their case, painting Socrates as a menace to the very soul of the city. Yet when it came time for Socrates to craft his defense, the philosopher stood deviant. He didn't take the expected pleas for mercy. Plato, his devout student, chronicled the proceedings in what would be known as the Apology, a misnomer for a discourse that was anything but apologetic. Socrates, with the shadow of death looming over him, chose to provoke rather than placate. He likened himself to a gadfly, a divine irritant sent to goad the sluggish Athenian steed into action. His words were a challenge. He said, quote, "I am the gadfly to the Athenian people, given to them by God, and they will never have another if they kill me. And now, Athenians, I'm not going to argue for my own sake as much as you may think, but for yours, that you may not sin against God by condemning me, who is gift to you. For if you kill me, you will not easily find a successor to me, who, if I may use such a ludicrous figure of speech, am a sort of gadfly given to the state by God. And the state is a great and noble steed who is tardy in his motions, owing to his very size, and requires to be stirred into life. I am the gadfly which God has attached to the state, and all day long in all places I am fastening upon you, arousing and persuading and reproaching you. You will not easily find another like me, and therefore I would advise you to spare me." Unquote. You think about this, this is a performance of staggering bravery. Socrates is not just defending his life, he's affirming the value of it, asserting his role as the conscience of Athens. Standing as the beacon of integrity, unyielding, even as the specter of death looms. The jury, unmoved by his audacity, cast their votes guilty. There was no room for debate, no moment for contemplation. Each juror silently placed his token, sealing the fate of a man whose only crime was to challenge the status quo. Now, at this point, Socrates is 70 years old and familiar to most Athenians. His views had turned many in the city against him. And so he's found guilty by a vote of 280 to 220. And then the jurors are asked to determine Socrates' penalty. And they argued for the death penalty. Socrates is given the opportunity to suggest his own punishment. He probably could have avoided the death penalty by recommending exile, but instead he initially offered the sarcastic recommendation in true Socratic fashion that he be rewarded for his actions. And then when pressed for a more realistic punishment, he proposed that he be fined in a modest sum of money. And faced with these two choices, death was selected for Socrates. The philosopher was taken to a nearby jail where his sentence would be carried out. An Athenian law prescribed death by drinking a cup of poisoned hemlock. Socrates would have to be his own executioner. And again, we go to Plato, and he describes this as the voice of the fictional character Phaedo. He says, quote, "When Crito heard, he signaled to the slave who was standing by. The boy went out and returned after a few moments with the man who was to administer the poison, which he brought ready mixed in a cup. When Socrates saw him, he said, 'Now, good sir, you understand these things. What must I do?' 'Just drink it and walk around until your legs begin to feel heavy. Then lie down. It will soon act.' With that, he offered Socrates the cup. The latter took it quite cheerfully and without a tremor, with no change of color or expression, he just gave the man a stolid look and asked, "How say you, is it permissible to pledge this drink to anyone, may I?" The answer came, "We allow reasonable time in which to drink it." "I understand," he said. "We can and must pray to the gods that our sojourn here on earth will continue happily beyond the grave. This my prayer, and may it come to pass." With these words, he stoically drank the potion quite readily and quite cheerfully. Up until this moment, most of us were able with some decency to hold back our tears. But when we saw him drinking the poison to the last drop, we could restrain ourselves no longer. In spite of myself, it came in floods so that I covered my face and wept. Not for him, but for my own misfortune, losing such a man as my friend. Credo, even before me, rose and went out, when he could check his tears no longer. Apollodorus was already steadily weeping, by drying his eyes, crying again and sobbing. He affected everyone present except for Socrates himself, who said, "You are strange fellows. What is wrong with you? I sent the women away for this very purpose, to stop with their creating such a scene. I have heard that one should die in silence, so please be quiet and keep control of yourself." These words made us ashamed, and we stopped crying. Socrates, when he said his legs were becoming heavy, lay on his back as the attendant instructed. This fellow felt him, and then a moment later examined his feet and legs again, squeezing a foot hard. He asked if he felt anything, and Socrates says he did not. He did the same to the calves, and going higher, showed us that he was becoming cold and stiff. Then he felt them for a last time and said that the poison had reached the heart and he would be gone. As the chill of sensation got to his waist, Socrates uncovered his head. He had put something over it and said his last words. "Credo, we owe a cock to Asclepius. Do pay it. Don't forget." "Of course," said Credo. "Do you want to say anything else?" There was no reply to this question. But after a while, he gave a slight stir, and the attendant covered him and examined his eyes. Then Credo saw that he was dead. He closed his mouth and eyelids, and this was the end of our friend, the best, the wisest, and the most upright man of any that I have ever known. Now we have to take that with some salt grains, because if most of us drank hemlock, then we'd be in extreme pain, convulsing and gasping for air until we died. But this is Socrates, so you know he's doing it all heroically. And then his last words here were like, "Hey, we owe somebody some money. Make sure you pay that." And some scholars say that Socrates can see his death as a sort of freedom, a freedom of a soul from the unreasonableness of humanity and the confines of his body. And maybe he was so stoic and unconcerned about it because, again, with his not knowing, maybe death was better than life. We won't know until we get there, but what a story, right? What a narrative. What a legacy. And I was thinking, how can I sum it all up? What can I say that would show the lasting impact and legacy of this most influential philosopher in Western history and Western thought and the Western tradition? Maybe a modern philosopher could say it better than I could. So I went to the words of Cornel West for a final quote for this show. And he says, quote, "The Socratic love of wisdom holds not only that the unexamined life is not worth living, but also that to be human and a democratic citizen requires that one muster the courage to think critically for oneself. This love of wisdom is a perennial pursuit into the dark corners of one's soul, society, and world. This pursuit shattered one's petty idols, false illusions, and seductive fetishes. It undermines blind conformity, glib complacency, and pathetic cowardice. Socratic questioning yields intellectual integrity, philosophic humility, and personal sincerity, all essential elements of our democratic armor for the fight against corrupt elite power." Unquote. And this is the Socratic legacy.